Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, we find out what Trump's immigration policy has actually meant for the American economy. Is the government on the right or the wrong track when it comes to tackling rising inflation and energy costs? We debate. Plus, the system is broken and completely out of touch, argues the author of a new book called Age Against the Machine, and we talk to her about how the modern workplace treats older staff. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, naturally, there was a lot of conversation this week about the spikes in inflation. So I wanted to explain, to get the show on the road here this week, the difference between how inflation is measured in Ireland and in the Eurozone. Now, we talk about CPI in Ireland, and that's the composite price index, and it's designed simply to measure the change in the average level of prices of consumer goods and services. But that's not what they're looking at the ECB, because it's the HICP is designed specifically for international comparisons. And what that stands for is the Harmonised Index of Consumer Prices. So the primary difference in between the two is the inclusion of mortgage interest. And that is not included in the HICP. So really, what I'm saying here is that you're going to hear about the CPI in Ireland, but in the Eurozone, which is where they make the decisions about interest rates, they're looking at something slightly different. Now, the central bank has warned that headline inflation could rise to as high as 4.2% if the conflict in the Middle East persists. The bank says higher energy costs will feed through not just directly into fuel prices, but food, transport, and broader businesses' costs, but particularly hitting lower income households hardest and slowing domestic growth to as little as 2%. But we now need to understand what the solution might be to this challenge in households right across the country. And so we have invited Jim Power, well-known economist, to join us here on Taking Stock. Right, Jim. First off, Iran's effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz has triggered what the International Energy Agency has described as the largest ever disruption to oil supply. Can you walk us through at this stage what the consequences are to households across the country?
Okay. The problem in answering that question is that this is a live situation. Unfortunately, we have no idea how it's going to end, when it's going to end. And it is not difficult to envisage a situation that if this were to escalate, that oil prices could go a lot higher. But it's interesting that if you look at the oil futures markets, you know, they are very strongly anticipating there will be a sharp decline in the price of oil and natural gas in the second half of the year. And also, indeed, the OECD's recent economic forecast, the first official forecast produced by anybody since the crisis started on February 28th, it has built in a working assumption that oil and energy prices generally will fall in the second half of the year. So if you kind of assume that what we've seen to date is as bad as it gets, the question then is, how long is this going to persist? And unfortunately, we don't know when the war is going to end. We don't know how it's going to end. And we are operating in an environment of incredible volatility because every second comment that President Trump makes contradicts his previous one. So, you know, it's absolutely all over the place. I have rarely seen so much volatility in oil prices in my career. But if you look at, you know, what has happened to date. Year to date, Brent crude is up about 80%, European natural gas likewise. So that is going to feed through directly to inflation in the sense that we'll be all facing higher electricity bills, higher petrol, diesel prices when we fill the car. So that's the direct effect. And then the indirect or the secondary effect would be, you know, businesses faced with these sorts of increases in the cost of doing business will try and pass it on in higher prices to the consumer. The consumer, in turn, will look for higher wages to compensate. So that's the wage price spiral you could enter into. But the bottom line at the moment is that before the Iran crisis happened, Irish consumers were living with a cost of living crisis. February 26th, compared to 5 years earlier, the average cost of living was up by 23.9%, with wide variations in terms of different items we spend money on. But that was the cost of living crisis that people were still dealing with. And unfortunately, this will now be exacerbated by what we're seeing playing out over the last month. So the bottom line is that consumers for the foreseeable future are facing higher electricity and gas prices. They're facing higher petrol and diesel costs directly. And of course, then that the risk is that feeds into every other price out there in the system. So real incomes are going to be squeezed. And for consumers, you know, it's just more pressure and an already pressurised situation. So whatever way you look at this, Susan, it's not good news.
Well, Jim, I do want to pick up on one thing that you said there, and that is you have rarely seen such volatility in the oil price in your career. And to be fair, I'd say there has been rarely as much volatility in general that we have seen in so many levels in different areas. But I do want to ask this. If you're in the position of Andrew Bailey or Christine Lagarde or Kevin Walsh to be or Jay Powell as is, the thing is volatility doesn't help central bank planning because volatility may not necessarily mean that prices go and stay up. So how does the very nature of all this uncertainty fit into central bank decision making?
Okay, there is the debate. There's two schools of thought here. And first of all, actually, I'll start off with a quote directly from the OECD's economic outlook last week. A supply-driven increase in energy prices should be looked through if inflation expectations remain well anchored. Okay, and this is the kernel. There are two issues that central bankers are grappling with at the moment. You know, on the one hand, inflation is rising, and we saw the Eurozone rate go from 1.9 to 2.5% in March. The Irish rate has gone to 3.6%. So already a month in, we're starting to see the impact on consumer prices. So a central banker would look at that and say, inflation is rising. There is a danger now of secondary effects and that inflation becomes entrenched in the system. So we will move to increase interest rates to try and anchor inflation expectations. So in other words, if you can convince consumers and businesses that you're going to do whatever it takes on the interest rate front to prevent inflation from becoming entrenched in the system, that is what we call anchoring expectations. So that's one school of thought. The second school of thought, of which I would be more of an advocate, is that the disinflationary impact of what's happening at the moment, in other words, the damage to economic activity that the sharp increase we're seeing in energy prices and indeed other prices that will feed through, that the negative economic impact will more than offset the inflationary impulse.
So you'd cut interest rates?
Well, no, I'd leave interest rates unchanged. You know, there's no argument to cut rates at the moment. It's either leave them unchanged or increase them. Prior to the February 28th Iranian attack, I would have predicted that ECB interest rates would remain unchanged for the duration of 2026. The markets are now pricing in 2 to 3 interest rate increases this year if this energy shock persists. I think increasing interest rates in this sort of environment is a mistake. But as I say, the markets believe the ECB is going to do it. So for any consumer or business out there, I'm not predicting this, but I'm just because we don't know, but I'm just saying that people should actually plan for the eventuality that rates might rise by a half to three quarters of 1% in the next 12 months.
I wonder whether we're looking at the wrong thing altogether by simply wondering if interest rates are the primary way of dealing with this type of inflation. And I just want to quote to you something Christine Lagarde said in her speech from the ECB and its watchers. And this was on the 25th of March. So admittedly, it wasn't in the last couple of days when we've seen the last recent developments, but it was while the war was well underway. And she said, monetary policy cannot bring down energy prices. That's obvious to all of us. Then she goes on to explain how the strategy that she outlined for 2025 is the one that she believes is going to lead us through this shock. But I'm just wondering then, are central bank tools as we know them, are they still relevant for today's globalised connected world?
No, I don't think they are actually. I think the interest rate is now an incredibly blunt tool for dealing with a crisis like this. I think governments and fiscal policy have a much greater role to play here because, as I said, you know, increasing interest, well, as you just said there, quote from Lagarde, increasing interest rates will not bring oil prices down. You know, that there is no doubt about that and will just exacerbate an already difficult economic situation. But that's the only tool that central bankers have. I think it's the wrong one. I think governments have a much greater role to play because if governments step in and they actually help businesses and consumers deal with this energy price shock, that in turn might obviate the need for businesses to increase prices, for consumers to push for higher wages. So government actions can prevent a wage price spiral from developing in the system. And I think that would be much more effective than central banks. If I was a central banker at the moment, I would sit on interest rates, do nothing for the foreseeable future and let governments deal with this issue because interest rates represent a demand management tool. You know, if demand is too strong, you increase interest rates to curb demand or vice versa. Whereas this is not a demand problem. This is a supply side problem. Increasing interest rates, in my view, is not the way to deal with a supply side problem. But I repeat again, it's worth reiterating, doesn't matter what I think, the markets currently believe that central banks will increase interest rates this year.
It's interesting what Christine Lagarde said about fiscal policy, because she said targeted government policies can help smooth the shock by reducing energy demand, which we're hearing qualitatively as distinct to with any regulation. And she says compensating lower income households. But then she went on to say, but broad-based and open-ended measures may add excessively to demand and strengthen the pass-through. I was trying to read between the lines there, Jim, because if I was Christine Lagarde, one also has to protect the institution that one is leading. So what is she really saying there? Is she saying, look, we need you to help us out here. There's only so much that we can do. Or is she basically buying a bit of time until she and the team with her figure out what's going to happen next, which is difficult by anybody's measure?
Yeah, she's buying time. There's no doubt about that. She is as confused as the rest of us at the moment about where this is going. And obviously, from her point of view, how does the ECB react to this? You know, I think her preference would be to do nothing for the foreseeable future. But after the Ukrainian spike in prices and, you know, general inflation, the ECB actually was criticized for acting in a tardy way. And when they start increasing interest rates, the damage is already done. I actually don't believe that to be the case. I think the ECB held off for a while, and I think the ECB handled the crisis reasonably well. So I think increasing interest rates at this juncture would be premature. I think she recognises it's premature, and I'd be very surprised if for the next couple of months we see any possibility of an ECB rate increase. I think she wants to buy time to sit back, see what actually happens. And if she starts to see these second round inflation effects feeding into the system, well, then she might change her mind on the interest rate front.
You mentioned there a little bit earlier on that there's no good news in this. And if I take the position, the starting position that we're at now, it contrasts a lot to what Christine Lagarde painted the picture of back in 2022. She said before the Russian invasion began, oil prices had increased threefold between October 2020 and March 22. She says in terms of gas, it was €340 per megawatt hour in 22 versus €60 today. She said the euro area is in moderate recovery and the unemployment rate is low by historical standards, but we no longer face acute labour shortages. Putting on an Irish lens to that, do you think the economy and the people that comprise it are in a better position to weather this storm than, let's say, the Russian invasion, than the COVID pandemic and previous, in the last 10 years, economic shocks we've had?
Well, I mean, from okay, if you look at the European story, I mean, the European economy up to February 28, the signs were starting to look a little bit better. Okay, there was a reasonable level of resilience there, but I certainly wouldn't describe the Eurozone economy as an economy that was anything remotely like firing on all cylinders. You know, it was a subdued growth performance, albeit a little bit better than might have been expected. The Irish economy comes into this in a pretty resilient place. You know, modified domestic demand increased by 4.9% last year. That's a solid, resilient performance. But the sectoral breakdown of that, it was dominated by the multinational sector. You know, output was up by over 25%, whereas output from the domestic economy was up by less than 1%. So I think if you're in retail or hospitality, and indeed 2/3 of the personal sector out there, very, very vulnerable to what's going on at the moment. And I probably think in a more vulnerable place today than would have been the case with COVID or the Ukrainian situation. You know, if you talk to people in retail and hospitality, it's been a bloody tough environment for the last 12 months. There's no doubt about that. And a lot of government-induced increases in the cost of doing business were feeding through this year. Minimum wage, auto-enrollment and so on. Insurance costs, energy costs, you name it. The pressure is on businesses like that. And of course, wage pressures have been intense as well. So I actually think Ireland is in a more vulnerable position today than it would have been during the last couple of crises.
Jim, as ever, there is far more to talk about than time allows, but we'll have to close it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining me. Jim Power, very well-known economist.
Thanks, Susan.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, ageing against the machine. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my trivia this week, I was in a town which is at the southern tip of Ireland's third largest lake. It has a stone bridge connecting to a town in another county and has a narrow island known locally as Between the Waters. Where was I? Have a think and I will give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, are you a worker who is in their 50s and perhaps you feel that you could go for another good few years yet, but you're hearing vibes about retirement is great or this is a young person's job? Well, as our population gets older, it's ever more important to think about these things and make sure we hear all perspectives on the labour market. It's great to welcome Lucy Standing, co-founder of Brave Starts, an agency that supports employees over 50, and author of Age Against the Machine, which hits bookshops later on this month. First off, Lucy, what I really liked about the book is how you challenge the idea of having retirement, first of all, at all, and secondly, that retirement should just be focused at the latter part of one's life and after their career. Will you take us through your thinking on that, please?
Yeah, sure. I think the main thing to say is that people have got so much to contribute to the world of work. And that actually, as people get older, a lot of their experiences change. What we value, what we need, what we want out of work shifts a bit. And so, for example, when we're younger, we want things like more money, status, ego, climbing a corporate ladder. As we get older, we focus a lot more on what we want to give back, how we want to mentor, how we want to shape, guide, provide stability for others. And that, as a set of skills or as a set of motivations, is certainly for so many jobs in society, something that is hugely desirable. So I'd like to maintain that connection with the workplace.
And why do you think that is not a commonly held view, Lucy?
Because
or is it not?
It is, but I think it's not a commonly held view because I think fundamentally people are quite lazy. You know, organisations tend to do what's always been done and what's always worked in the past. So very few people are, you know, we're still operating very much in this environment where people are educated when they're young, they work for a tranche in the middle, and then they retire. And as we live longer and longer and longer, that's increasingly not going to be the norm because people just won't be able to afford it and society can't support it through tax paying and what have you. And so actually punctuating the world of work with periods of retirement throughout, let's not call it retirement, let's just take time off. If you punctuate your entire life with lots more periods of time off to have children, to retrain, to move into a completely different career, to set up your own business, to enable yourself to keep on contributing to the world of work, it's going to require that we have a lot more flexibility in how we view that kind of approach.
And when you say we, do you mean governments, employers, society, employees themselves?
Yeah.
Who's we?
It's everyone. You know, so governments are really not actively thinking about this yet, because it's not really a very strong vote winner. You know, if they turn around and say, actually, we're going to have to start unpacking what we really mean and think about retirement, because it's going to be unsustainable as we go forward, that's not going to win many people votes. Organizations tend to do what's always been done. You know, if you ask organizations, because we've spoken to 226 of them, and say to them, hey, what are you doing to prepare for this aging workforce? Most of them go, yeah, you know what? It's not a business priority. You know, it doesn't have the urgency of things like COVID or Brexit. And the business case for it isn't 100% clear, because it takes leadership. You know, if you're doing something different, it takes someone to take that bite at the initial bite of the cherry.
If I could then explore the societal or governmental angle for a moment, let's say that they were to take on board your idea of punctuating one's life with time off. And you mentioned examples there. Okay, caregiving to a child or indeed to a parent is one that can become very urgent, because you can't just put that on your desk for another day. But the others, retraining, maybe simply taking a break, as you mentioned there about a side, setting up your own business, etc. But Lucy, let's say that you and I were to look at those examples and we're two very different individuals. How then could government structure that? Is it that, for example, you'd have in mind every couple of years that one could take a paid career break and their social security would pay for that? Or how would you structure that in line with very different individual preferences and lifestyles?
I think it's quite simple, actually. I mean, if you were to give to every citizen 25 years, which is roughly what people have now, you know, when you retire at 65, average life expectancy is about sort of 82, 83. So government at the moment is providing a state pension to most people, you know, along the lines of sort of 12,000, 13,000 a year. So over time, that annualizes up to being about sort of 250, 300,000. So if you were to sort of say to people, right, you've got the equivalent of 25 years that is going to be funded, but you can take up to 5 of those years before the age of 65 and the rest of it after it, then actually people can take that time off throughout those sort of the working years to do those sorts of things like retraining, but then leave the bulk of it till a little bit later. So that's for example, one idea.
So give people autonomy about where they would choose to take the time. That's an interesting thought. Can I also ask you, though, about the fear that people would have about perhaps doing that, and because they might lean out of their career, when they come to leaning back in, they would maybe have to build up their networks again, notwithstanding that they might have taken time out to retrain. So let's assume that they're upskilled. But certainly, and I'm interested in your work from the agency point of view, certainly when I might talk to maybe women who are returning to the workplace after taking time out to care for children or elderly parents, they often have that sense of their network now needs to be rebuilt, and sometimes their identity needs to be, from their own perspective, reframed as well. What would you say to that concern that might hold back the engagement with such an initiative?
Well, I think most people who do full-time jobs and are reliant entirely on doing a full-time job are actually putting themselves in the most vulnerable position. Because actually, organizations are not really that invested in thinking, you know, what is your future going to look like in 5-10 years? They care about their role right here, right now. You know, if you look at the amount of organizations who are predicting the sort of the amount of churn that they're going to be, you know, kind of taking their employees through. And churn doesn't mean retraining. It means firing and getting rid of and hiring new skills. So with the development of things like AI and so on. People who work full-time are probably in the most vulnerable position. Whereas if you're working, or if you're thinking about yourself and you've got income, for example, through several different sources, your ability to be knocked or have the kind of the wind knocked out of you is much more reduced, because you're spinning several plates.
A portfolio career.
Something like that, which is increasingly the norm. You know, I mean, if we think about, you know, where jobs are heading, you know, we've seen, for the ONS data will show you that there is the number of full-time vacancies has been in decline for 40 consecutive months. So, you know, the job market, job vacancies are not expanding, particularly when, you know, governments are concerned with raising tax on labour and increasing minimum wages and so on. You know, these things contribute to a lot more reticence in the employer market to take on full-time jobs. The other thing is people are demanding more flexibility. You know, if I look at my audience, very, very few of them come to me saying, Lucy, I want another full-time job. Most of them are saying, I'm leaving the corporate world because I have to have more flexibility in order to be able to look after parents, carers, what have you. So it doesn't tend to be the sort of thing that they're driving for either.
One of the things you do in the book very effectively, both historically and geographically, is challenge the assumption that with retirement comes a pension. Because as you point out, when the pension concept was introduced, life expectancy was underneath the age that one could expect to draw down a pension. And therefore, in many cases, people would never get it. It was introduced here in Ireland in 1909. It was the year that my granddad on my mum's side was born. Like, a pension isn't that old, again, in terms of a concept.
It isn't, yeah.
So I think, and I'm just going to take a quote from the chapter related to this. You said, from the Middle Ages through to the start of industrialization, most people in Europe gradually reduced their income based on circumstances such as motivation, health, wealth or ability, not their age. Will you talk us through that, please?
Yeah, I mean, I get, well, from that historical angle, and certainly even nowadays, you know, we still see countries where there is no such thing as pension provision. You know, society was always built much more around, you know, the family unit and children being born to, in a way, look after parents. You know, there are different cultures and societies now where that is very much the norm. You know, they would look at us with this sort of sense of abhorrence, really, that as people get older, we palm them off onto the state and expect the state to do a better job of looking after them than, you know, their own families.
But you also put forward the argument, and very strongly, particularly in chapter two, that work is good for people, not just from a payment point of view, but from routines. Definitely. And so on. So I'm getting from you, Lucy, that it's not that you're against retirement, it's that you're for prolonging the working one's working life disparately across their life instead.
Entirely. Yeah. I mean, why should the best, you know, the leisure time, the availability of all of that leisure time, why should that be left to a time in our lives where we're most likely to be experiencing, you know, disability, you know, aches, pains, more likelihood of experiencing death? You know, it seems to me to make a lot more sense that actually, instead of leaving all of those years to the latter part of our life, we punctuate it throughout the entirety of our life. And certainly every marker of successful aging, you know, the people who have better cognitive health, physical health, life satisfaction, all of those people have a stronger sense of purpose. And that connection is largely built through work, because quite frankly, people are solving problems together, working with other people, maintaining connections with others, you know, and doing things for society. And that means something.
Let's say then, people are listening to you today and they're ever more motivated to do that. And they might be a little older and are concerned that recruitment practices are against them. You say, Lucy, we need to rethink how recruitment works. What suggestions do you have for that?
Well, firstly, I'd say to all of those people who are in that position that they are right. Recruitment processes are ageist. So they are going to have a stronger, they will have more of a struggle than other people. And I think it's important that we acknowledge that, because a lot of the time people, it's a lonely place, and it's very disheartening to keep on getting rejected or ghosted. In terms of doing something about it, I think the common thing you'll hear people say is, you got to change your language in adverts. And I think that's I think that's not even getting to the tip of the iceberg. You know, we have to fundamentally rethink how we value work. You know, if work is much more about the output that people produce, there is very little that means we'd have to then work a 5-day week. And let me just explain that briefly, because no, it's not that entirely clear. I just had a phone call with a man who runs a business where it's basically providing care in people's homes. And he says, look, as long as people turn up and as long as they're doing the hours that work for them, they are incredibly reliable. So it could be two mornings a week, could be one day a week, could be three afternoons a week. But we can make that work because we've got over 2,500 different clients. So there's a way that we can structure jobs that isn't just 5 days a week, Monday to Friday. There's a way that we can, I guess, build up on this idea of the the portfolio career, the autonomy, people working one day a week for one organization, half a day somewhere else, and maybe 3 days somewhere else. But actually being really clear about what are you going to give me on those days? What are we contracting for here? Taking a more entrepreneurial approach.
If I had been speaking to somebody about how flexible working practices needed to adapt after COVID, if I needed to talk to somebody about who had child caring or elderly parent caring requirements, I would probably hear the same answer. So is the ageism, the solution to ageism in recruitment, is that actually more applicable to other challenges or dislocations in the labour market today in your view?
Yes, absolutely. The fundamental thing to address ageism is a more flexible workforce. You know, you nail that. It's a solution for pretty much everyone. The other big thing would be to select people and have recruitment processes focused on measuring how people actually perform in the job. Because at the moment, most selection practices focus on asking people to submit a CV. And a CV does not predict future job performance. The correlation, you know, if you look at a CV and look at how they perform in the job a couple of years later, the correlation is 0.06. In other words, completely random.
And so is it competency-based interviews then? Or how, if one was to avoid the CV and take your advice, what would that mean in practice then, Lucy?
I'd ask organisations not to advertise on jobs boards, to put things on their own websites initially, to ask people to submit an application by, you know, actually filling out an application form. What are you interested in about this role? What proof have you got that you understand the problems that this role would address? How are your skills a good match for this? What do we need to understand about your personality that you think would make us a good fit for this organization? Because people have to jump over. You know, it shouldn't be so easy for me to send off 300 applications in a day because I'm just hitting easy apply.
And you haven't even mentioned about the role that AI can play in that. I really think your book is actually not just about age at all. I think it is about just taking away biases that maybe have challenged our thinking or not challenged our thinking about across the labour force. It's a very interesting read and I love the research that you've put into it as well as your personality that has come through in it with your fellow authors as well. Lucy, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Lucy Standing, author of Age Against the Machine.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
This is Susan A's Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Up next, what the American South looks like when you don't let any immigrants cross the border. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Culleton. Now, I was telling you last week that after the trivia slot from the week before, I had a chat with our researcher, Simon Keane, about the speed as well as the length of the River Corrib. Well, I received some messages from you about it. Jeff O'Connor sent in an email saying, folks, you may find that the Garavogue River in Sligo Town is shorter. And this was further backed up by a text we got from Declan Sweeney who said, the Garavogue River in Sligo is the shortest river in Ireland. Galway has enough feathers in its cap. It's nice to share it around. Therefore, to set the record straight, here's what I found. The River Garavogue is often cited as Ireland's shortest significant river, but the River Corrib is known as one of the shortest major or fastest flowing city rivers in Europe and it connects the Lough Corrib to Galway Bay. And I hope that now sorts it out for everybody. Okay, in an open economy, immigrant labour plays an important role in sectors like hospitality or construction. And anybody who's completed a J1 summer in America will attest to this. With the coming of ICE, there is an impact of lifestyle, the economy, supply chain, the amount of immigration that is both happening and being avoided in the US. There's a lot to it. And so to unpack this, Guy Chazan, US national correspondent at the Financial Times, joins me now. Guy, you recently visited the Rio Grande Valley area in Texas, which is close to the Mexican border. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was hanging out with builders in South Texas who are very angry about the actions of ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Their agents have been launching raids on construction sites in that part of Texas and scooping up undocumented migrants. Obviously, they've been doing this all over the country, but it's particularly sensitive down there because so much of the sector relies on migrant labor. And in many cases, this is migrant labor without the right paperwork. But it's just been the common practice of the industry in that part of the world to rely on those people, and they're really, really struggling without them.
When you say scooping up, would you mind explaining to us what that experience has been like for those people?
Well, basically, they just come in unannounced onto construction sites and start interrogating the workers and checking for their paperwork. And if they can't provide the right paperwork, then they just detain them. And in many cases, they're then deported. And this has been very, very disruptive for the industry. I think a lot of them have actually been really outraged that ICE agents can even do that, you know, that they can march onto people's property and onto these construction sites and pick people up. And in fact, they've been complaining about this with their Republican lawmakers in D.C., in Washington, saying, how can they even allow this? How can they even do this? And as a result, a lot of them have actually started putting fencing around their construction sites, because that's the only way to actually deter the ICE agents.
You mentioned that this is a common practice in this part of the world. And let's just understand, when you talk about that geographically, what that also means sectorally. You had a piece in the Financial Times recently about this, and you said construction, agriculture and hospitality together make up as much as 9% of US GDP. And traditionally, these sectors would have a lot of immigrants employed in them, illegal or legal. So what are the ramifications of even the threat of ICE then, as well as the actual implementation of what they're doing, on day-to-day life in America?
Well, it's creating, certainly for employers, it's creating a big headache, because they already had a very tight labor market. And this has just made it much, much tighter. I mean, there are real labor shortages in critical parts of the economy, especially things like hospitality and construction. And agriculture is a little bit more complicated, because there is a very effective temporary visa system in place at the moment for agricultural workers, people who come in to help with the harvest and so on. And that has been functioning quite efficiently, and it's being expanded. But you don't see that in other sectors of the economy. And the result is that there are severe shortages of labor. And this is increasingly a problem in places like Texas. I mean, I spoke to people in all walks of life, in the hospitality sector, in construction, also in the agricultural sector, and all of them are saying that this is a big, big problem for them.
Of course, people are people, Guy, and therefore, if somebody is coming from a less wealthy background, they may still be consumers in certain environments. I'm choosing my words carefully here, because we're talking about people and yet we're looking at this from an economics lens. But I'm very aware that we are talking about human beings and their lifestyles and the threat of what could happen to them. When we specifically look at the consumer spending by immigrants, it's set to fall between 10 to 40 billion this year. And monthly employment growth could turn negative, and GDP growth will be between 0.1 to 0.3 percentage points lower, you quote. Do you think any of this would influence the decision making in Washington about that?
Absolutely. I mean, the interesting thing is that it already is influencing policy making. What's happened in Texas is that various associations of builders have been lobbying their MPs, their lawmakers in DC. They've been having meetings with ICE, and they've expressed their outrage and deep concern about what's happening. And that does seem to be having an effect, because actually what's happening is that the raids by ICE on construction sites have diminished in recent weeks. And I think it's because, you know, it's classic lobbying at work. You know, they're going in there, they're telling decision makers in Washington that this is incredibly disruptive, and they've got to go easy on the construction sector. And I think the message has gone through. You're seeing it a bit with the hospitality sector as well. I mean, generally, I would say that there was a sort of peak of ICE activity around the time of the deaths in Minneapolis. The killing of Renee Good and Alex Preti, which I think caused enormous disquiet in American society. And I think since then, there's definitely been a kind of toning down of ICE operations. They haven't been quite so in your face as they were sort of at the end of last year or the beginning of this year.
And let's look at why ICE is being put to work, because the reality is that more than one in 10 young adults in America are neither employed nor in higher education and training. And the rationale of this is that if there are fewer illegal immigrants into the US, or indeed immigrants in general, therefore there will be more jobs available for Americans, and this 1 in 10 number would diminish significantly. Now, that's the logic. How is that playing out?
Well, the builders I spoke to just thought that was laughable. I mean, they have their own prejudices, but they essentially said there is no way that we can get domestic U.S. workers to replace the people who are being rounded up and deported at the moment. As I say, it's very difficult to really ascertain whether that's correct. But this is all anecdotal. But they are very, very dismissive of domestic U.S. workers. They say they just basically don't have the capacity to do this sort of, backbreaking, really hard work. I mean, they're essentially, laborers on these construction sites. They're doing very, very tough work, roofing, sort of pouring concrete, tiling. It's hard. And I get the impression as well that there isn't really a very effective apprenticeship system here. I mean, I used to report in Germany for many years, and they've got that down to a T. They've been doing apprenticeships now for hundreds of years, and it's a very effective system. And I just don't get the impression that it works so efficiently here. Certainly, that's what the construction guys were telling me. So there really is a serious problem. Obviously, the White House does want to get these people who are not in training and not in employment into the workforce, into the labor market, but it could prove harder than they think. And certainly, just using ICE to kind of round up immigrant labor is not necessarily going to lead to that happening.
We're of course very conscious that with every passing day, we move closer to the midterms. What is the narrative around ICE, do you think, particularly maybe to the more traditional Republican base?
I think that ICE and its immigration enforcement has been really, really unpopular with the sort of swing voters, not with the MAGA base, not with the real diehard MAGA faithful. They are actually very keen to see ICE really go in hard, and they supported Trump because he promised the biggest mass deportation program in U.S. history. That was one of the reasons they voted for him. And I think when you speak to voters, I mean, I've been tracking opinion on this for a while. You definitely feel that people are very, very supportive of the closure of the border. They feel that there was just sort of chaos on the border under Joe Biden, the previous president. And, too many illegals, as they call them, were allowed into the country. And they feel that this is good, that the border shut down, that chaos at the border is now over. But they're very, very concerned about ICE's activities, especially in big cities that are Democrat-controlled, like Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Chicago, that kind of thing, where they've really gone in hard and they've been randomly detaining and deporting people. I think that is a step too far for a lot of American voters, especially just moderate centrist swing voters in the middle.
Much of our conversation today has been about people going to work. But when you're talking about words like randomly swooping in, that leads one to question their freedom in going out at all. And it's something you refer to in the piece, is that if people are afraid to go out, people then may not turn up to work. People may not turn up to restaurants to go out and eat. And of course, apart from what that does to the local economy and so on, that really tears as well at the social fabric of people's lives and communities. So can I ask you that as well? Is it that far where people are literally afraid to leave their house in case that they're put on a plane home?
I do get the impression that the real peak of a sort of fear and the sense of terror has eased because, you know, I think it was a very important kind of inflection point when Kristi Noem was sacked as Secretary for Homeland Security, because she had been the embodiment of this hard line on immigration enforcement. And I think things have eased up a bit since then. You're not seeing so many sort of viral videos on social media of people just being sort of dragged out of their cars by ICE agents in the middle of the street. That's just not happening anymore, or at least if it is happening, it's not so conspicuous. But it is true. Everybody I've spoken to in sort of the hospitality sector, for example, have said that this is happening. This is having a real chilling effect on the economy because it's not just that you're seeing the labor shortages. You're also seeing, you know, suppressed consumer spending. People are just not going to restaurants. They're not celebrating. They're not having big parties in restaurants and hotels because they're just worried about ICE. And so the ramifications are really quite broad. It is really having this chilling effect across large swathes of the economy, and people are worried about it.
And if people are worried about things, of course, that changes behaviour around what they're planning to do as well. You mentioned that according to calculations by the Brookings Institution, the US experienced net migration of between -295,000 and -10,000 in 2025. And I'm guessing the reason there's such a wide disparity there is many undocumented are, as the name suggests. So therefore, is the US looking at basically a declining population for as long as the Trump presidency is in place and possibly beyond?
Well, again, there's a lot of controversy about those figures. Some people don't agree with the Brookings Institution figures and say that actually migration is net positive. It's a very, very slippery subject. But it's definitely the aspiration of people in the Trump White House, especially Stephen Miller, the deputy chief of staff in the Trump administration, who is on the record as wanting to bring down immigration. And he has often spoken in interviews of the fact that the period when America had very, very low levels of immigration, sort of between the 20s and the 60s of the last century, that was a kind of golden age for America. It won the Second World War. It became the sort of global superpower. It had a sort of very stable kind of political situation.
Whether it's a slippery subject or otherwise, it really is important that we talk about this and in both human and economic terms. And that's why the piece that you wrote was really striking. Thank you very much for joining us here at Taking Stock. This is Guy Chazan, US National Correspondent at the Financial Times.
Thank you.
Now, for the answer to my trivia. I was in a town this week, which is at the southern tip of Ireland's third largest lake. It has a stone bridge connecting to a town in another county and has a narrow island known locally as Between the Waters. Where was I? The answer is Killaloe. Ireland's third largest lake is Lough Derg. The stone bridge connects Killaloe in County Clare to Ballina and Tipperary. And the reason the island Between the Waters has its name is because a canal separating it from the main River Shannon creates a narrow island, and that's where it gets its name. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, please pop it into your WhatsApp groups too for anybody who might be interested. Taking Stock is also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of the show is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much indeed for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. I look forward to chatting to you next week, and have a very happy Easter.